It was one of America's largest gold mines. Now it's the site of some of the deepest underground science in the world. From SDPB, today is Thursday, May 8th. This is In the Moment. For over a century, the Homestake Gold Mine pulled millions of ounces of gold out of the ground. It stretched around 8,000 feet below lead. We dig into the history and impacts of Homestake with Erin Woodward. She is co-creator of the Price of Gold book. From an underground library to Sinai Creek to a share in the Nobel Prize, she takes us into the mine's unique history. And an exploration of the mine's scientific second life with Kelly Kirk is later in the hour. But first, a conversation about cleansing with Marty Tubbles Jr. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. The Homestake Gold Mine in Leeds, South Dakota, closed in 2002. It was one of North America's largest gold mines. Its underground tunnels and caverns got a new life in 2007. It was selected as the site for some deep underground science. The mine became the Sanford Underground Research Facility, a home for scientists exploring some of the universe's biggest questions. Today, thousands of feet below lead, a mining legacy and scientific present intertwine. Marty Tubbles Jr. was SURF's 2024 Artist in Residence. He returned underground this March. Tubbles led an engagement to cleanse SURF from what he calls the desecration of mineral extraction. He spoke with SDPB's Lee Strubinger.
The idea to Azalea or to Smudge was really kind of the only thing that I could think of in the moment that I could do that could, you know, both symbolically and within our belief system, you know, quite literally cleanse that space. Because it's still sacred to us, you know, even though they did what they did and it's been desecrated and they've, you know, poisoned the water, like it's still a sacred place to me and to my people.
I've never heard the word azalea before. Could you maybe explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so most folks might recognize it as smudging. That's kind of the more common term used, where you take sage or sweetgrass or flat cedar and you burn it and you use the smoke to, you generate smoke to cleanse a space with the smoke. Azalea is a Lakota word. That's our word for that process. And it's not as commonly widely known. And that practice exists within other indigenous communities and they have their own words for it as well. But it's just the word that I was raised with and the word that is within my community.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about sage being used to cleanse. Like, how might I understand what that means? Would that be similar to like when Christians take communion, something along those lines?
I don't know if I'd make that connection. From what I understand, you know, from what I know from my community, you know, when we azalea space, it cleanses the space spiritually. So, you know, if we feel like, you know, there's bad energy or, you know, a bad spirit in a place, we can use that smoke and it cleanses the space, you know, kind of pushes that energy out. But it also, you know, when we're sick, you know, we'll use sage as medicine in different ways. You know, sage is one of those traditional medicines that has a lot of different uses. But also the smoke from like sage can, you know, clear out sickness. And even quite literally, you know, there's been research that shows that sage smoke can, you know, take bacteria out of the air or you know, physically clear a space. But it's something that we do in our home daily. You know, it's a practice my daughters, you know, they do and they, you know, just understand it's just something that kind of daily living for a lot of folks.
How did you actually go about smudging the underground mine and the underground lab?
So I used an old stove, like an old potbelly stove, a wood stove. I've never done anything at this like this at this scale. You know, usually when we azaleo our home, we use an abalone shell and a small amount of sage, and that'll, you know, usually work for the whole house. But thinking about this massive, you know, mine system, I had to really spend a lot of time kind of figuring out what to do. And I had engineered this whole mechanism. I was like, okay, I got to make this, I'm going to machine this giant thing that I'll use to create the smoke and, you know, dissipate it. And had all these complicated plans. And a buddy of mine, he mentioned to me, he's like, hey, I have an old stove. You want to use that? And I realized, like, oh, yeah, actually, I don't need to make this complicated thing. Like, a stove like that would work. And the trick with the sage is you want it to smoke. So I needed to make sure that it sort of smoldered. I didn't want it to go. If it burned too efficiently, it would just burn up the sage and there wouldn't be a lot of smoke. So I had prepared it in a way that to try to keep it smoldering. That's what you'll see in the photos and the videos. It generates a lot of smoke. It generated a lot of smoke.
And then it looks like you have, we're looking at a photo right now of the wood stove, and it looks like the stove is next to one of the shafts. So you talk about it not being complicated, but it sounds like that's like the air intake and it just sent the smoke right down.
It is, yeah. So that shaft that I'm next to is one of the main work shafts, and it's, yeah, 4,850 feet straight down. So it was really scary being close to that. And surf, the folks at surf really took a lot of care in making sure everything was safe. So I was the only person allowed near the open shaft, and there were fences set up to help, you know, make sure no accidents happened. And they're very safety first at surf, which I really appreciated at my time there, because it is a big, you know, space, and it can be dangerous if it's not managed properly. But the way that smoke, was able to get dissipated through the mine, was through their ventilation system. When I was going through, I had to go through a bunch of safety training before I was able to go down into the mine. And during my safety training, I learned about this alarm system that they have where they use this stuff called stench, which is like it's this smell, it's harmless, but it's really stinky. It's the kind of stuff they put in propane so that you can smell the gas if it's leaking. And if there's an emergency, because the mine is so big and there are people working in so many different parts of the mine, if there's an emergency, they'll put stench into the air intake. So people are trained, if you smell this really stinky smell, you know there's an emergency and you need to clear out or go to a safe spot. And it all has to do with the way the air is circulated throughout the mine. So when I was thinking about this, you know, I realized, well, it'd be really easy to, like, if I set up and azaleaed in this one spot, that smoke would be carried down into the mine and kind of dissipated throughout and pulled out, you know, through the exhaust system. So it could really reach this vast network. And I was told there's, like, you know, 300 miles of mine system underneath there. And it's not all in use by surf, but it's still there from the homestake days. So it was interesting, and I was told by one of the facility people that their O2 sensors, they have, you know, these sensors all throughout the mine. The smoke from the azalea set their O2 sensors off, like, all the way down and throughout. So I wasn't sure if I'd really able to reach that deep. I was, you know, hoping, you know, in some ways this was very symbolic, but also very practically, I did want to get as far into that space as possible. And it really seemed like through their monitoring that I was able to really reach deep into the earth.
How much sage did it take?
That's a good question. It took a lot of sage and I feel like I got just enough. It took us about an hour to burn the sage that was sent in from different places. It was nice to get the confirmation from the facility that they did pick up the smoke on the lower depths. And, it's the most sage I've ever azaleaed with in my life. That's quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. What can you say about the performance aspect of this azalea that you did, in terms of you kind of put together the gallery show, the show that's going to be touring? You know, you got to perform in the vacant shaft before they started before they're starting to move towards building the sensors in those large caverns where the detectors will be. What can you say about this particular performance piece and where your art is taking you?
So the way that I talk to, you know, surf, and the way that I contextualize it for those folks was through the lens of art as an artist and art practice, and trying to help them understand, like, you know, this is an important part of our cultural practices, but also in a way is a symbolic act, you know, allowing my community into a space that is highly regulated, really hard to be in, in a place most people probably don't want to go, you know, be down there, but, you know, allowing us to send our thoughts and our prayers and our energy in there in a way that was both symbolic but actually, you know, quite physical, like having the smoke reach these depths. So it blurred the lines for me as an artist in a lot of these kind of compartmentalized practices. I don't feel comfortable saying that it was necessarily like performance art, because it's more than that, you know, and I don't feel comfortable necessarily saying that it was a ceremony, because it's also more complicated than that. And that was something that I really was hoping to get across with the scientists, is, you know, want them to understand, like, you know, within our culture, within Lakota culture, you know, we don't have the same kinds of separations between, you know, our thought and our sciences and our philosophies. We have a very holistic life view and worldview. That's what you'll hear a lot of people talk about. You know, we don't have a word for art necessarily, because it's something that's a part of our daily lives and a part of our, you know, creative existence. And in a way, you could call this a science, you know, thinking about, we use this medicine to cleanse a space. Like, this could be contextualized as an indigenous science. I think there's a lot of power in elevating that in a space that is very scientific in a Western perspective, a place where they're studying dark matter and neutrinos, and, you know, also acknowledging indigenous thought and belief in science is, I think, you know, potentially a really positive thing to do there.
Is there anything you wanted to add that I didn't ask about?
I think one of the things that I really try to be mindful of in this thing, I mean, you asked about my art a little bit, and, you know, there's things that I do that are kind of just for anybody, any kind of, you know, my audience is open to anybody. There's some things that I do that are specifically just for my tribal community. Although, you know, other people might see it or enjoy it, they're my first audience. But I'm always careful to not misrepresent and be misunderstood. Like, this engagement, this artistic engagement, this practice, with Azalea, something that I did, you know, with my community, but also it was my decision. You know, I'm just a person. I'm not a, you know, a tribal leader. I'm not a medicine man. You know, I don't speak for Lakota people. You know, it's just me. And I want to kind of make that clear, because I think sometimes it's easy to misunderstand, like, you know, this isn't, and I'm not trying to absolve Homestake Mine or necessarily endorsing everything that's happening at SURF. You know, this is just my kind of humble act to, you know, make a some kind of, you know, positive healing effort in a really complicated space.
That was Lee Sturbinger's interview with artist Marty Tubbles Jr. In March, Tubbles decided to Azalea, or Smudge, the Sanford Underground Research Facility. You can find the full story on sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. Before the break, you heard SDPB's Lee Sturbinger's interview with Marty Tubbles Jr. Tubbles was the 2024 Artist in Residence at the Sanford Underground Research Facility. Now, here are the personal stories of those who worked underground and lived above ground in Lead. In its past life, SURF was the home state gold mine. The mine sustained its company town, Lead, with plentiful jobs for 125 years. It contained a gold supply that seemed like it would never run out. It was a safe employment bet until the price of gold fell steeply in the 90s. Just like that, the lifeblood of the town was gone. We're going to learn more about the mine's second life later in the show. But first, Erin Woodward is co-creator of The Price of Gold, stories from the Homestake Gold Mine. She joined me via Zoom.
The book is a partnership between myself and my friend Nick Hubbard. We've been friends for quite a long time, so it was such a terrific opportunity to collaborate with him on something in a creative way. Nick and I joined SURF at such an interesting time. Myself, as I said, as a science writer, and Nick was working as a photographer there before leaving to found his own company, Frontier Creative, in Rapid City. So we came, as I said, at a very special point in SURF's history, in this underground facility's history. That is a centuries long story. And kind of just to set the stage, I mean, the human history of this area goes back to, you know, several Native American tribes who to this day view the Black Hills as sacred. And then we had these federal expeditions into the Black Hills, which discovered gold in the area and spurred that Black Hills gold rush in the 1860s and 70s. That resulted in this conflict and these broken treaties that displaced the American tribes. But then for 125 years, Homestake was this economic engine in South Dakota and really supported the state through multiple world wars and through the Depression. And then you fast forward to the 1960s, and we had this first major particle physics experiment deep underground while Homestake was still operating that would eventually win a Nobel Prize in physics. And then at the end of the century, we saw the closure of the mine and that just devastating impact on the community and on the region there. And then several years later, the state of South Dakota invested in fundamental science and we saw the birth of the Sanford Underground Research Facility. And for, you know, over, I think it's maybe close to 20 years now, we've seen these amazing scientific undertakings happening there, including the largest physics experiment that the United States has ever invested in. And so this was like the backdrop that Nick and I, as young 20-somethings, kind of just, you know, when we walked onto set, this is what we were walking into. So when we joined, Nick as a photographer, me as a science writer, we were able to meet dozens of people who had decades of experience at the mine, before having it as a science facility was even a thought. And many of these people, we have them to thank essentially for the fact that the science facility was able to reopen. You know, it was their institutional knowledge of the underground and that vast underground landscape and all of the equipment that had gone unused for many years. And it was their knowledge that allowed the facility to really open up safely and become a science lab that it is today. So we had so many incredible conversations with them about their lives, about what Homestake meant for them and how it, you know, shaped the state of South Dakota. And many of them were planning to retire. And we realized that we were going to stop hearing those stories. In a couple years, they would be retired and not really on the scene anymore. And so that's what really inspired Nick and I to sit down with these folks and record those stories and that history.
Why is it important to get those stories archived or preserved?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, so many of these folks, their stories are incredibly representative of what life was like even just 5 decades ago. So many of the things that were happening on a state and national level are reflected in their lives. For example, many of the stories that they tell have to do with serving in the military during the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, and the war in Afghanistan. So many of them went on strike for better pay so they could better support their families. The decision to disconnect the price of gold from the US dollar kind of ultimately led to not being able to keep the mine open, even though there was still gold underground. All of these things that, you know, happen and unfold on these state and national levels really do have these real world impacts. And so as they're sharing stories with us about, you know, their day-to-day life and some of the funny things that happened underground, the horseplay, the nicknames, their lives lived, it also comes up alongside these real world impacts of, you know, the decisions we make as a community and as a country. And I think it's really important that we take a look at that and take a look at the real world impacts and remember those stories so that we can make good decisions for ourselves into the future.
Yeah, I also want to ask you about Woody or Paul Hoover.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Woody Hoover, official name Paul Hoover, but yeah, Woody is quite the character. So enjoyed our time with him. Yeah, what do you want to know about Woody?
Well, can you describe the tour that he gave you?
Yeah, absolutely. That was probably one of the greatest opportunities that came out of this project. So, and probably the most memorable interview. Most of these interviews took place in people's living rooms or their backyards. They were kind enough to welcome us into their homes. But for Woody, he was the emergency rescue team lead at SURF at the time. And he, I think he has since retired, but he guided us to the Four Winds hoist room, which is on the 4850 level. And that hoist room connected the 4850 level to even deeper levels. Not quite sure exactly how far down it was supposed to connect. I know that the Homestake mine got down to 8,000 feet at one point. So there are quite a few levels underneath the 4850. But that hoist room was decommissioned around 2000 and was actually underwater for several years before the facility reopened. It is a huge cavernous underground space with massive machinery. And when we walked in, you know, everything had this kind of reddish hue from the oxidization of being underwater and just completely frozen in time. There were books that had been set out. There was an old phone and an old swivel chair, all of these things that had just been left to time. And it kind of felt like images you see of the Titanic in that way. And it was an incredible thing to see. Obviously, it's not in operation at this point. And it was an incredibly sharp contrast from the other spaces underground where science is happening. Mm-hmm. And those spaces, you have class 100 clean rooms where there's only 100 particles of dust per cubic foot for science, right? Incredibly cutting edge, world-class facilities. But, you know, there's other parts of the mine that are just maintained for safety, not maintained for science. And so the ability to go explore those with somebody who could keep us safe was incredible. And Nick took some incredible, amazing photos of those spaces that I think really communicate kind of the raw ruggedness of the underground and this place that people were working day in and day out.
Yeah, Nick's photos really stood out to me, especially those giant photos of it looked like rust to me, just the very rusty, ancient machinery, ancient meaning, you know, 50 years, but still. What do you hope readers take away from his pictures throughout the book?
So I'm always blown away by Nick's talent in photography and his ability to tell a story. I think the picture into the underground spaces is incredible at conveying that real ruggedness of these were the spaces that people spent 12 hours at a time doing this incredibly physically intensive, laborious, often very hot work. To really convey the realness of that. But the other types of images that are included are these absolutely stunning film portraits of the people whose stories are included. And I think each of those are really just a window into their hearts and their souls. All of them were taken right after they spent 2-3 hours with us telling us their stories. And I think that allowing them to revisit all of those memories really brought that to the surface. And I think that you can see that in his photography and see that in their faces.
Okay. And one of the things I need to ask you about is the underground library. Can you share that story to listeners?
Yeah. So the underground library is probably one of my favorite stories and one of the ones that I think people connect with on a very deep level. Rick is talking about this space that not everyone knew about. You had to know where it was in order to find it, where you could kind of sneak through the rock and some boards to this small room that just had a ton of books in it. And he described it as a space where people who had recently come to the United States, who maybe didn't have a great grasp of the English language and were kind of trying to build up that ability to speak in English, not only to relate to their new community that they'd found and lead, to work towards that citizenship test to become a United States citizen and to be able to stay there for the long haul. And, you know, working underground, your main goal, the company goal, is to break rock, to move rock, to make money. And so management probably wouldn't look too kindly on people sneaking away for breaks in this underground library to read books or to sit with each other and help each other learn how to read. So that's why it was maybe a bit more secretive. But the existence of this space was just a testament in Rick's mind to the commitment to each other, the commitment to your community. And that if somebody came here and wanted to be part of that community, you were going to do what you could to help them communicate, to help give them that language, to help them pass that test, to stay as part of that community. And you were, you know, you were their brother, you were their family, you were their community, and they were dedicated to each other in that way. And he talked about it with such a gleam in his eye. You know, it was like this opportunity for them to really come together as a community and protect each other and help each other. And the fact that it was kind of this secret underground library, I think, is just really captures people's imaginations. But what it is just people supporting each other, which I think you really see throughout South Dakota. I'm really proud that that story made its way into the book.
Rick and Mike both also talked about horseplay in the mine, which you kind of touched on already. There was a whole lot of shenanigans and pranks, but that also kind of ties into the dangers of the mine because sometimes that horseplay could get very, very dangerous. Can you talk a little bit about the dangers of mining down there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in some ways the horseplay was a little bit of a, it served as a release for them to have that constant stress of understanding that the work was hard, the work was unsafe in many ways. It was very stressful. And so they do talk about how a lot of the horseplay was a way of them kind of relieving that stress and just being human with each other in this space. So it does very closely relate, but yeah, there, it's hard work and often dangerous work. And I believe that it's over the 125 years, there were around 400 people who died either in the Homestake mine or in mines along the Homestake belt. So that's 400 people who passed away in an effort to get this gold. And there are multiple stories of people who either lost neighbors or friends or brothers, or who were involved in rescues that helped save someone from passing away in the mine, or recovery missions of people who had to go in after there had been a rock fall and remove the bodies and get them up to the surface. And so a lot of these stories are lighthearted and fun, but they're punctuated by this really heavy reality that the community faced and the losses that they faced in the Homestake mine. And so we did choose to include quite a few of these really heart-wrenching stories, because I think it helps tell a fuller picture of what that life was like.
Yeah, and another story that was negative and kind of had long-ranging impacts was Jim Whitlock's. Can you tell us a story of Cyanide Creek and his bacteria?
Yeah, so I think many people who lived in Lee Deadwood in the 60s and 70s will remember Cyanide Creek. As a byproduct of the gold processing process, Homestake was left with cyanide and ammonia, which are a very toxic chemical substances. And rather than holding on to them or trying to deal with them in some way, they put them into Gold Run Creek, which flows into Whitewood Creek, which flows through Deadwood. And for years, the community dealt with this creek that was toxic and was lifeless. There's no fish, and it couldn't use the water for anything. And it essentially became this dump. And it wasn't until the Environmental Protection Agency was created in the 70s that the federal government really was empowered to come to Homestake and say, look, you're putting toxins in the water for these people who depend on you, and these people don't have the power themselves to force you to stop. And so the federal government, the EPA, said you need to stop doing this or we're going to have to stop operations here. And because of those machinations, Homestake was forced to look at the problem. And because they were forced to look at the problem, Jim Whitlock, who was a biologist, and Carson Whitlock, they weren't married at the time, but now they are. Carson is a chemist. They were both working in the metallurgical department at Homestake, and it was them who, along with their colleague Terry Mutter, discovered a organism that lived in the creek and had evolved this ability to survive the cyanide and ammonia and actually eat it in some way and use it for energy. I won't get into the science here, mm-hmm. but they made this discovery and they were able to, from that discovery, create a biological treatment option that had never before been discovered that could neutralize the cyanide and ammonia and process those toxic remnants of the gold refining process mm-hmm. into something that was harmless and could actually be dumped into the creek without damaging the water or having toxins in any way. And they discovered that. They were able to demonstrate that it worked mm-hmm. to the EPA. They were able to implement it and create this entire water treatment facility at Homestake. And not only that, they took that solution to mines all around the world and were able to help other mines be more environmentally responsible. And, you know, going back to what we talked about earlier, these things that happen on a state and national level really mm-hmm. impacting everyday people's lives, that whole story means that today people go fishing in Whitewood Creek all the time and catch these, you know, record-setting trout, because it's safe now, and the water is safe for people to use, and to fish in and to swim in, and I think it's a heartwarming story of people being able to come together and use science to really create good in their world.
I love that. I absolutely love that. So my last question is, after writing this book, what do you think is the price of gold?
Yeah, so that truly has been the through line of this entire body of work. Every single person is so closely connected to the Homestake Gold Mine and has so many thoughts and feelings about what that mine meant to them and to their families and to their communities. A lot of them are really grateful for it, but a lot of them acknowledge that it took a lot from them. As much as it gave, it also took. And I think that's something that we need to be aware of, these forces in our lives that can bring us so much good, but can also take a toll on our families and our communities, and to really evaluate what that is and what that means to us. I don't know that I have a specific answer. I think the answer is in the book. And so I hope people can read it and reflect on what the price of gold was for each of these people and even for themselves in their own lives.
That was Erin Woodward. She is co-creator of The Price of Gold, Stories from the Homestake Gold Mine, along with photographer Nick Hubbard. Woodward and Hubbard will be at the Sanford Lab Homestake Visitor Center for a book signing event. That's on Thursday, May 15th in Lead. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. We're ending today's show by exploring Homestake's mining past and scientific present as the Sanford Underground Research Facility. Kelly Kirk is the director of the Sanford Lab Homestake Visitor Center in Lead. She joined me over Zoom. So before your interview, listeners would have heard stories of the miners of Homestake Mine, but miners weren't the only people riding that elevator down below the earth, especially in the 60s. Can you tell me about Raymond Davis Jr.?
Of course. So Ray Davis was actually born in Washington, D.C., and then after World War II, started working for Brookhaven National Laboratory. And he was a chemist by training. And when he started at Brookhaven, he asked his boss, you know, what is this new job and what should he be doing? And his supervisor supposedly said, you figure it out. And so with that, he went into Brookhaven's research library, discovered a bunch of materials about neutrinos, became absolutely fascinated, and committed kind of his scientific career to understanding the mysteries of neutrinos, which led him eventually to the Homestake Mine.
Yeah, can you break down his solar neutrino experiment and what it discovered?
Yes, so the solar neutrino experiment, he wanted to understand kind of the processes that were fueling the sun. And he had worked very closely with John Bacall. And Bacall had equation that kind of would lay out how many solar neutrinos they should see in this experiment. Now, this experiment took place at the 4,850-foot level in the Homestake Mine, kind of just off the Yates Shaft for easy access. And they put in a 100,000-gallon tank of dry cleaning fluid. And the thought was that neutrinos, they interact very rarely with matter. But when a neutrino would hit the dry cleaning fluid, and they'd be able to actually count those. So they were supposed to be able to compare it right to the equation that John Bacall had developed, these observations. And this experiment ran was built in 1968, and it ran for about 30 years. And throughout this time, they only saw about one third of the predicted neutrinos. And so that became known as the solar neutrino problem.
And what was the legacy of that experiment?
This is what is so fascinating. And this is one of those stories we really like to tell students, right? Here's this 30-year-long experiment, and it's not achieving quite what they had predicted. And so it raises all of these questions, right? Is the original math wrong? Is the experiment not working correctly? Or are we seeing something new or different and helping us change the understanding of kind of particle physics as we know it? And so the solar neutrino problem led to a lot of other experiments that also were kind of exploring neutrinos and their properties. And what was discovered is that neutrinos actually come in three flavors, and they can oscillate between flavors as they travel. And so Ray Davis's experiment did actually see the right amount of electron neutrinos, the neutrinos that were coming from the sun, that he should have. It's just that because he's only seeing one of the types of neutrinos, right? His experiment could only count the one type. He wasn't getting that predicted number. And so essentially, this Homestake experiment opens up kind of a whole new understanding of particle physics and particularly of neutrinos.
And it also kind of played a role in the founding of SURF. Can you tell me that story?
So it's so interesting, is kind of how time works, right? This experiment goes throughout the 1990s. In Homestake history, they're starting to get ready to shut down the mine. And Homestake pulls up its last bucket of ore in 2001. It's beginning the decommissioning work throughout 2002, 2003. At the same time, Ray Davis's work receives a Nobel Prize in Physics in 2002. And so this really kind of brings to light this story of incredibly successful science at the space that was the Homestake mine, that it's cosmically quiet, incredibly stable rock, and that this could be a potential space for additional experiments. And so that I think really helped kind of fuel the charge and the investigation to turning the space into the Sanford Underground Research Facility.
So, in what ways does the history of like the Homestake gold mine still show up at modern day SURF, would you say?
Oh, goodness. So there's both, I'm going to say, kind of the tangible and intangible ways, right? In the tangible ways, we still have a lot of legacy buildings. You can still see, right, the historic headframes. We take visitors to the Yates Hoist Room, which was constructed in 1939. And, still some machinery, right, that was built by Homestake for Homestake. So these kind of very tangible kind of sites of Homestake legacy. But we also have that intangible, right? There were a lot of Homestake veterans who came back and worked and helped transition this space into the Sanford Underground Research Facility. They had that deep knowledge of place, of the rock structure, of safety in an underground space, of how to operate the hoists and shafts, and to do the maintenance that is required in these spaces. And so that the legacy that they have left and the stories they have shared which we see in The Price of Gold, are still very present today.
And a big part of The Price of Gold was also talking about the miners bringing humanity into the mine. And one thing that really stood out to me was the murals throughout the mine. In what way does surf bring art underground to this day?
So we have the Sanford Underground Research Facility Artist in Residency Program. And it has been incredible to see this program just blossom over the years as artists from all over the world apply, go through a process to be selected, and then get to spend 4 weeks on site here, going underground, meeting infrastructure technicians, hoist operators, research scientists from all over the world, outreach team members, engineers, and really kind of getting a full sense for the scope, the scale, the history, and the future of this space, and then transforming that into something very visible and tangible, for an audience to explore and experience. And every year, it's such a different final show, final exhibition, that kind of points out or highlights different aspects of surf's history and the science that occurs here.
What is the number one thing or one story you want people to leave the visitor center knowing?
Oh, goodness. I want them to understand the sheer variety of talents, skill sets, and knowledge bases that it takes to conduct science underground. It is so incredible to see people with this deep knowledge of how to operate the Yates hoists, moving people and machines underground, to be able to reassemble machinery underground, to come up with and brainstorm an experiment that will help us understand the secrets of the universe, and then build that experiment out and keep it running, and then having people who can tell that story for generations to come and inspire curiosity in others. It's such an incredible team.
Yes, and you guys are doing quite a few different types of experiments underground. Besides neutrinos, you're also doing experiments in dark matter, for example. But is there one experiment you want to lift up?
I think one of the things that we kind of like to highlight is that we actually have 30 experiments underground right now, in geology, engineering, biology, and in physics. And so while DUNE, the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, is one of our major pushes right now, there is so much happening underground, and it's exciting to see those experiments develop.
That was Kelly Kirk. She is the director of the Sanford Lab Homestake Visitor Center in Lead. And that was our show for today. On tomorrow's In the Moment, we'll bring you an hour on another book in conversation with the history of the land. Tune in for Lori Walsh's interview with author Rebecca Clarin in front of a live audience. We dedicate the show to The Cost of Free Land, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance. In the Moment is hosted by Lori Walsh and produced by Ari Youngman and me, Ellen Kester. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.